You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Kate Archer-Ken. Coming up, an expert will help us identify poisonous plants that are commonly found in Wisconsin.
First, yesterday at the state capitol, lawmakers held a hearing for a controversial bill that would ban University of Wisconsin resident doctors studying obstetrics and gynecology from learning how to perform abortions. Abortion opponents and medical organizations lined up on opposite sides of that issue yesterday to testify.
Representative Andre Jacques joins us now. He's the author of this bill and is a Republican from DePere. Representative Jacques, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Great to be back.
Well, why did you introduce this bill?
Well, I think very simply to get around a legal dodge that the UW has been using, which really the Attorney General's office doesn't feel is on any sort of solid legal ground. But we have a longstanding prohibition here in Wisconsin and in many places elsewhere in the country on the use of public dollars for subsidizing abortion. And what we have right now is that you have essentially state employees on state time within the scope of their state employment, paid by state taxpayers and with state benefits and with their liability insurance paid for by the state, performing abortions at Planned Parenthood's Madison abortion facility, participating in abortion procedures and training to be abortionists. And this puts a stop to it by really adding some clarifying language, although honestly, I believe that UW is already in violation of state law, and really, Ledge Council more or less confirmed that at the hearing yesterday.
Well, how would this bill work exactly? Break it down for us.
Sure. So basically, it extends to state employees, and we already have extended to the UW and the Hospital Clinics Authority, or state authorities under Chapter 233, this prohibition on the provision or payment for abortions, with certain exceptions that are already outlined in state statute. And so what we've seen elsewhere, and certainly there are other programs, both public and private, throughout the country that do not offer abortion training, you essentially would prohibit those sorts of arrangements like what UW has with Planned Parenthood, where you really can't find anything similar throughout the rest of the country, where a state agency is essentially operating as the abortion contractor for a private entity like Planned Parenthood.
Well, so you're mentioning here that medical students are currently getting trained through this partnership with Planned Parenthood because Wisconsin prohibits public funding from being used for abortion training. So that law is in place already on prohibiting public funds from being used for abortion training. Why do you need to add the layer with this bill on top of that?
Well, no, you don't understand that UW is currently paying those medical residents for doing the abortion training. And they're also paying the UW employees, several of them. In fact, for a while you had the medical director for Planned Parenthood essentially being a full-time UW employee who had half of her faculty contact hours purchased from UW by Planned Parenthood to be providing those services. Now, they're going to claim that there is some sort of a reimbursement, but there is no reimbursement exception under the statutes. It's not like you could be running campaigns or operating a strip club or any sort of other private enterprise, and as long as there is reimbursement, it's okay. It essentially, the UW is providing the lion's share of abortions at Planned Parenthood. And unfortunately, once again, you had Planned Parenthood, which was in the room but unwilling to testify as to the arrangement and what goes on at the clinic, nor did you have a UW attorney that was actually there to testify. And I think the reason why is because they very clearly would have, under questioning, had to admit the fact that accreditation was not at all at issue.
You said you're on pretty firm ground here, but are you, in the eyes of the court, are you concerned that this bill would create an undue burden on women seeking an abortion? The Supreme Court struck down Texas abortion restrictions last year.
This is not about state-level abortion restrictions. This is very separate from those sorts of things. State of Arizona in 2011 put in place a similar restriction against public dollars for abortion or abortion training, specifically mentioning abortion training or the use of any tuition dollars or fees or anything that's intermingled. They even have a history long before that. If you go back to a Maricopa County residency program, or even going back into the 70s, I believe, in Arizona, where they have had different restrictions on the books. And there have, as in Wisconsin in the past, been claims that, oh, no, this is going to strip accreditation. Of course, we've seen that that doesn't happen, and shouldn't be a surprise. I mean, you have the same sort of restrictions within the U.S. military. Well, the U.S. military operates a medical school, which includes an ACGME-accredited OBGYN residency program, and you don't see abortions performed through the U.S. military either.
Talking right now with Representative Andre Jacques. He's Republican from DePeer, who authored the bill that would ban University of Wisconsin resident doctors from learning how to perform abortions. We want to play a clip from the hearing, the public hearing yesterday. Here's a retired family doctor from Madison, Calvin Bruce. He testified against the bill on behalf of the Wisconsin Academy of Family Physicians.
You would not dictate to the cardiac surgeons how they should teach bypass surgery, nor to the neurosurgeons how they should teach brain surgery. Does it make sense to presume that you know better than obstetricians how to teach their craft?
What is your response?
Oh, this is certainly something that, you know, again, as was noted, there were obstetricians in support as well as in opposition that testified at yesterday's hearing, as well as family medicine doctors. And this is something that already is not a required part of OBGYN training in Wisconsin or elsewhere. There already is the ability to opt out, but I think, as we also had testimony, there is intense pressure that has been put in place in Wisconsin and elsewhere for individuals to engage in such training. Otherwise, there might be some sort of retaliation within their evaluations and their basically their coursework. So it is something that There was thorough written testimony submitted in addition to, I think, very extensive verbal testimony given in support of the bill yesterday, that there essentially might be an ideological push to provide abortion training. But in reality, as was testified, the same sorts of procedures that would be used in a pregnancy termination are also used in miscarriage or the removal of a child that dies in utero, where essentially, the skill set is already learned, just as you had doctors that basically deal with repairing the complications from abortion, both Dr. Lynn, who testified yesterday, as well as Dr. Cousins from Green Bay, those are the sort of techniques that you learn in an emergency room, and that's honestly where those patients would be treated as well, not in an abortion clinic.
Really quickly here, as we wrap up, there is real concern here that the UW would lose its accreditation, the UW-OBGYN residency program losing its accreditation. There's also issues with a shortage of doctors, especially OBGYN doctors in rural areas, and that this bill could impact that as well. What do you say to that?
Well, there's kind of this false premise that this is going to lose accreditation and therefore you're going to have a shortage of OBGYN doctors. You know what? There's never been, I mean, demographically, we have such issues within the medical field and elsewhere that, yeah, absolutely, we have a shortage of doctors, but this is not going to at all affect accreditation. In fact, one of the abortionists at Planned Parenthood, who is a state employee, has in the past been part of various Physicians for Choice groups and, you know, at the national level, been very involved. He has admitted that there is no way that this is going to remove accreditation. He says that you
and we're gonna
what's
we're,
that?
We're gonna have to leave it there, Representative Jacques. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Sure. I would also mention the National Abortion Federation study also admitted that that accreditation could not be removed.
And that was Representative Andre Jacques, a Republican from DePeer, talking to us about the bill he authored that would ban University of Wisconsin resident doctors from learning how to perform abortions.
Stay with us on Central Time. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
POCA is celebration. It's community. It's family. It's also our official state dance. And perhaps no town in Wisconsin is as POCA mad as Pulaski. Sean Connolly brought his dancing shoes to the 4-day Pulaski POCA Days Festival.
Just 20 miles northwest of Green Bay lies the village of Pulaski, Wisconsin, a quiet rural farming community, at least for 51 weeks out of the year. but for one weekend every July, this village becomes the place to dance the official state dance.
I'm Harold Otto, General Chairman of Pulaski Polka. Started 38 years ago in our beautiful village.
I met up with Harold on opening night of the four-day festival. He was hosting an online radio show.
On 24/7, polkaheaven.com. It's worldwide.
And filling me in on the festival at the same time.
So we got people here from Chicago, California, Oregon, Washington, Maine, first time being out here, Vermont,
I've seen an overall good variety of people, you know, young and old.
I also met Gene Marashik. He's been playing Polka Days every year since it started.
I hate to say it, but the polkas have been going away by the wayside, and this is a good way to bring it back, get these people back here to see that it's a lot of fun. You know, my mom and dad were really involved with polkas. They always went to dances, and it just started getting the family together. And it turns out even my son, Jeff, Joel, they're playing in a new generation band.
Yep, I'm Jeff Marashik, and I've been kind of the leader in playing with the new generation band for, this is our 20th year playing as a band.
So as John likes to say, this is the theme song from the Titanic for you right here. One called Everyone's Reaching Out for Someone. Too soon?
Since we were old enough to stand up, we were going to polka dances and got to be about 14 years old and decided it was time for us to start our own little band. We kind of branch out and do a little more modern stuff. We take some modern day songs and make them into polkas.
As I continued around the festival, I ran into another father and son. Dennis.
Dennis Petushak, and I've been playing polka music for the last 43 years.
And Thomas.
Sure, I'm Dennis's son, growing up with polka music my whole life, watching my dad and different family members play.
It's uplifting music, especially in the Polish style, because we've kind of beefed it up a little bit and souped it up, different than the German and Bohemian style. So it's a great time to get out there and we call it kick your heels.
For our family, you know, here at Pulaski Polka Days, it's kind of like a semi-family reunion. You see everyone. We know so many people here in town. You can't go about 5 feet without knowing someone.
Or in my case, someone who knows my grandfather, a polka musician who played in Cousin Fuzzy and His Cousins. They had one of Green Bay's first live television programs in the 1950s. Harold was quite excited to hear about this.
Would you believe I have right next to me Bob Connolly's grandson?
That's me, Sean Connolly.
Oh, my
yes,
Sean.
That's a whole other story. But my suggestion for any Wisconsinite is to visit Pulaski Polka Days at least once. It's festivals like these that keep music and family traditions alive.
Sean Connolly is a producer based in Green Bay. He's currently working on the Wisconsin Polka Project, a documentary capturing the stories of polka from the people who lived it. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now there's nothing like a walk in the woods to take in the wonders of nature here in Wisconsin. There are lots of hiking trails and nature paths to explore throughout the state, but it's almost equally important to know where not to walk.
Joining us to help us identify poisonous plants that are commonly found in Wisconsin is Vijay Pandian. He's a horticulture educator for the UW Extension in Brown County. Vijay, welcome back to Central Time.
Okay, thank you.
Well, lots of hiking and biking going off the beaten path this summer. What is the most commonly found poisonous plant we're likely to come across in the woods?
Well, this is a great time of the year that we like to, you know, get outside and do some adventurous stuff, either camping, hiking, or kayaking and things like that. But oftentimes, you know, when we stroll through some wooded areas, we'll come across a lot of poisonous plants. And quite often, we don't know most of them, and I think. Say, one of the common ones are the cow parsnip. And it kind of looks like a leaf looks like kind of like a giant maple leaf and has a tall flower head that looks like a Queen Anne's lace, except, you know, the flower head is a little bit larger than Queen Anne's lace. Poison ivy, which is one of the most common one, it has leaf of trees, has a compound leaf, and the middle leaf is slightly larger. That's another common one. Wild parsnip, maybe if you go for a biking or anything along the roadside, you will see it typically. At this time of the year, they have a yellow color flower head that resembles like a Queen Anne's lace, except it's yellow. That's very common at this time of the year. Plus, there are some couple of other ones like stinging nettles. If you kayak around, you know, moist areas nearby, if you do see, a narrow-shaped leaf, which has a lot of the stinging hairs along the stems as well as on the underside of the leaf, those are mostly stinging nettles. And the cousin of the stinging nettle is the wood nettle. They have more of a broad oval-shaped leaf. And these two plant species, stinging nettles and wood nettles, are commonly found in the moist, damp areas. So if you kayak or if you camp nearby the lake, you know, you'll typically find these things too.
Well, Vijay, going back to wild parsnip, I understand it has a long tradition in Wisconsin. What about the sap getting on our skin? What does it do to us?
Yeah, you know, wild parsnip is an invasive species in Wisconsin, and every year it's been spreading so crazily around. And you will typically find it along the roadsides, prairies, you know, these things. Now, it has a toxic sap called solarin. And this sap, you can find it actually along the leaves, stems, you know, anywhere. So if you, in case the sap gets in contact with your skin, it causes some severe rashes and blisters. And especially if your skin is exposed or the sap has been exposed, to a bright sunlight, then, you know, it's going to aggravate the pain. So if you do get into contact with the sap of this wild parsnip, it's best actually to move to a shaded area very quickly and put up a moist, damp towel on those infected skin right away.
It seems that we get schooled on poison ivy at an early age to stay away. Is poison ivy still very easy to come by here in Wisconsin?
Oh, yes. Especially this year with all the rain that we got, I think we're seeing a lot of poison ivy, actually. In fact, when you go for a walk in a park or in wooded areas, you will see quite a bit. The poison ivy, you know, it can grow like a more like a erect shrub or maybe kind of like a vine type. But you can spot it very easily. It has a leaf of three. Now, the tricky thing about the poison ivy is that some of the leaves doesn't look same. They have some little bit of morphological differences, actually, on the leaf shape and texture. Some of the leaves may have some sort of like a tooth to it, and sometimes they don't. And some of the leaves may have a little half to it, and sometimes they don't. So if you do spot any of the plant which has like a three compound leaves, but the middle leaf seems to be slightly larger, it's best to stay away from them. And these poison ivy from the roots, until the leaves and stems, they also have, a poisonous sap. And that is called eugenol. That is a chemical compound called eugenol. And that also causes some rashes and blisters if you do come in contact with this sap.
Talking right now with Vijay Pandian. He's a horticulture educator for the UW Extension in Brown County. We're discussing poisonous plants that we find here in Wisconsin. Vijay, how should we treat ourselves, or what should we do when we come in contact with these poisonous plants, such as poison ivy? What should be our way of reducing what is going on with the poison?
Well, that's an excellent question. The first thing is that try to ID the plant if you can, or maybe take a photo shot, actually, using a smartphone and send those photographs to your local county extension office and get it ID'd. Because once you know what the plant is, then probably you can take some necessary precautions in how to handle it and how to manage it safely. And second of all, when you're walking into unknown territories, in the woodland areas, or in your park, make sure to wear a long sleeves, shirts and shoes and boots so that your skin is not exposed, okay? The third thing, probably, especially with dealing with a poison ivy and things like that, if you're doing some management, make sure to wear a long, thick rubber gloves, actually, and put those pulled out plant into a trash bag. and then you trash it. Make sure to wash those contaminated clothes actually in a separately. Don't mix it with along with your regular type of clothes, okay? And also, you know, when you're digging these plants, you know, you may use a digging fork or a shovel or even like a, you know, handhoe. Make sure to, you know, clean those garden tool equipments right away after you dig these poisonous plants, because you don't want to actually, you know, have those saps, you know, stay on those equipments and then you use it later on for some other gardening purpose and get in contact with those staff again. Now, one thing I also like to suggest is that, you know, it's always good to carry some moist you know, towel along with you all the time. Just in case if you do get into contact with these kind of sap, you know, immediately, you know, put those, you know, moist towel on the infected skin area and move to a shaded area. And if you do get some severe rashes and blisters, you know, contact your doctors right away and get some medical attention.
VJ, my grandmother always wanted to put calamine lotion on me. What about calamine lotion?
Certainly you can use that. You know, if you do have some, you know, minor blisters and rashes, certainly you can use those calamine lotions too, and those things also help, yes.
Are there any other ways we can avoid these plants as we go on our adventures this summer?
Well, you know, most of these plants are native species, actually, and they use these chemicals as a defensive mechanism. Unfortunately, you know, we can't completely avoid them, but one thing we can do, we could try to, you know, get to know these plants by properly IDing it and trying to stay away as much as we can and take some all these precautions, you know, if needed. You know, or you talk to your local parks department and see, you know, what is the presence of these poisonous plants in this particular park or wooded area, and get to know and try to stay away from those territories as much as you can.
Well, VJ, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me. Appreciate it.
That was VJ Pandian, horticulture educator for the UW Extension in Brown County. And we've been talking about commonly found poisonous plants in Wisconsin. You can see the full WisConText article with photos and descriptions of those plants over on the Central Time Facebook page. We know the biggest names in Hollywood, whether we want to or not. It's hard not to come across stories about the daily ups and downs of the Kardashian family and stars of the reality show Keeping Up with the Kardashians.
Kardashians are an example of celebrities with one of the most loyal followings out there. People know what they like to wear, what kind of salad they're eating, and who they're dating at the time, and they devour controversy surrounding the Kardashians. Here's a clip of Kim talking about the PR war between her husband, rapper Kanye West, and singer Taylor Swift on an episode of Keeping Up with the Kardashians.
I feel like I've had it with people blatantly treating my husband a certain way and making him look a certain way. Kanye is always so honest and speaks his mind. And, you know, when we were first dating, everyone would talk and he always had my back. At this point, I really don't give a so I'll do whatever to protect my husband.
Our next guest wrote a book that asks a simple but powerful question: why do we care so much? Whether it's a chart-topping musician or an Instagrammer with millions of followers, many people are at least curious about, if not obsessed with, the lives of the people in the spotlight.
Julie Clam joins us now. She's a New York Times bestselling author, and her new book hit the shelves yesterday. It's called The Stars in Our Eyes, The Famous, The Infamous, and Why We Care Way Too Much About Them. Julie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Julie, what kind of answer do you come up with when you take a crack at that fundamental question, why do we care about celebrities?
You know, I think that it's actually very interesting. There was a study done at Duke University. This neurobiologist had a bunch of rhesus monkeys. He gave them all a very salty snack and gave them the option of either having their favorite drink, which was cherry juicy juice, or looking at pictures of the high status or celebrity monkeys. And they chose looking at pictures of the high status monkeys. And they actually had to be bribed to look at pictures of the B-list monkeys. So I think we're hardwired for it. I think there's something like in within us. You know, the sort of easier answer is when the things that we do to make ourselves feel better, that we do to get out of our heads, watching movies, listening to music, watching TV, going to a ball game. The people that are responsible for these productions are the people who we end up following as celebrities. They're, you know, if you have a favorite baseball player or a musician, and you see them, they make you feel good, they remind you of feeling good. Then you see them in a magazine, and it turns out they have the same Uggs as you, and it's kind of exciting, and you feel closer to them, and it sort of goes from there.
It's kind of sad to think of us as a bunch of monkeys, thirsty monkeys who've just eaten salty snacks,
monkeys.
And we'd rather look at celebrity monkeys than have a juicy juice box. But you're saying that our urge is that primal and that strong?
Because the question of why... There are things where you're just sort of like your head snaps to look at whatever it is. And, you know, my thing is I'll go onto Facebook, you know, in my, you know, attempts to procrastinate entirely and see some celebrity is trending. And I have no idea, you know, I don't know why Charlie Sheen, for example, somebody I'm not really interested in. But I want to know what's going on. Why is he trending? I'm assuming he's done something. Whatever's going on with him is worse than whatever's going on with me. And I sort of go down this rabbit hole. And, you know, again, he's not big in my life. But I sort of, oh, look at him, his ex-wife, you know, her ex-boyfriend, Richie Sambora. Then I'm thinking, what is Jon Bon Jovi doing these days? And, you know, it's like before you know it, it's time to make dinner.
Right. And you talk about how... In the early days, you know, celebrities were almost like these gods and goddesses, and they were glamorous and beautiful and untouchable and kind of mysterious, and that has reversed now. With social media, you can have access to people. It's, at least it feels like intimate access 24 hours a day, and there are celebrity gossip sites, and there's Instagram. What is it like living in an era when we have constant 24 hours a day access to celebrity culture and celebrities themselves?
Well, you know, I mean, you know, you talk about in the old days, it was you got a very curated picture of a celebrity. A publicist would set up the photo shoot with the magazine. They would, you know, make sure the house looked perfect, the quotes were appropriate. You know, now we have this sort of unfiltered, you know, where celebrities can, you know, get drunk and tweet 50,000 ridiculous things or whatever they want to do, and there's no filter. And so, you know, on some level it's a good thing, because their messages are clear. We get them. We don't have to worry about somebody spinning it. And on the other hand, you know, some of these people are really not capable of that, of having that much airtime.
One of the celebrities that you have been, and you write about this in your book, a little obsessed with over the years, and for various reasons, is Jennifer Aniston. Why do you think it is that we're drawn to particular people, particular celebrities, and we bypass somebody else? You're not so much an Angelina Jolie person, but you're very into Jennifer.
You know, I think, you know, part of the thing that I talk about in the book is that, you know, all of the things that you feel about these people really do tell you something about yourself. When Friends came on TV, I was single and sort of floundering, and I totally related to the Rachel character. Whenever I saw her interviewed, she would be charming and self-deprecating, and I started to root for her, and then, you know, she sort of evolved, and she started to be this, like, much more glamorous, you know, the long, shiny hair, then Brad Pitt, you know, and there was this whole sort of preoccupation with it. You know, she particularly, as a star, who, if you see her, you feel like she's somebody you would talk to, you know, you would feel comfortable talking to. She is a friend of mine who is a celebrity journalist. We had this talk years ago about the, you know, Jen versus Angelina thing. And he said, Jennifer Aniston is like a woman you'd see walking down Madison Avenue. Angelina is other, you know. And in my book, I say, you know, I imagine her, you know, that when she gets up in the morning, a bunch of bluebirds wrap a robe around her because she's this Venus, you know. And I can't relate to her. You know, the things that she does, you know, when she was younger, I remember there was a story about her carving her boyfriend's name into her arm. It's like, you know, that ain't me. So I think we find people that we relate to more. I think when we're, attracted to a specific storyline in a celebrity's life, it's very indicative of what we're going through. I mean, I was distraught when Jen and Brad broke up, and I'm sure that it was connected to the fact that my own marriage was starting to break up at that point. And I kept, looking at their pictures and thinking, they looked so happy and they looked so great together. What went wrong? You know, why? Why? I honestly had a lot of things in my own life that would have been, could have used my attention a little bit more than that. But, there I was.
We're talking to Julie Klamm right now. She's the author of the new book, The Stars in Our Eyes, The Famous, The Infamous, and Why We Care Way Too Much About Them. And Julie, Alec Baldwin had a rant a while ago. He's been kind of in this on and off again war with the press, the media, and the paparazzi. And he says clearly this obsession with celebrities is just people who don't have a voice politically. Washington
right.
is broken. They're kind of disenfranchised, but they can vote thumbs up or thumbs down on various celebrity escapades. And he
yeah.
thinks that's really sad. Is there something to that critique?
Well, I think that that was, I think Alec Baldwin is a guy who has a very passionate reactions to things. I think he was really angry at that point about how he felt he was being treated by, the paparazzi, and, rightly so. A person, should be allowed to live their lives comfortably. I don't know if, everybody who's interested in the celebrity story feels like they don't have a voice in the world. I think that, we do like to think of them as not being, as being sort of the gods and the goddesses. They're not going to, if I'm going to be, gossiping about, Ben Affleck, it's not going to get back to him. I'm not going to have to worry about it. I can't do that about the people that I actually know. But the whole thing of it is a sort of safe, guilty pleasure. It's you're not going to gain weight. You're not going to need an addiction counselor. You're not going to have to spend a lot of money. It's just sort of a this day I'm going to look at an InStyle magazine and see pretty gowns and somebody's gorgeous house.
So you're saying it's about escapism as much as anything else?
I think so. And I think that the more, the news becomes this flaming dumpster fire, the more you look to, I've been watching movies lately that are like, as complicated as, Disney, Beauty and the Beast. I feel like I can't take any more tension. There's all of these, really nice escape movies or listening to music or whatever it is, and certainly the people associated with it are the ones who are responsible.
Julie Klamm is with us right now. We're talking about her new book, The Stars in Our Eyes, The Famous, The Infamous, and Why We Care Way Too Much About Them. Coming up in a little bit, we'll talk more about that and also scandals and celebrity and what's different between politicians and celebrities when it comes to a scandal.
And we want to know what you think at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us what you think makes a celebrity. Which ones did you or do you continue to follow? Tell us why you find them interesting. Are you interested in the lives of celebrities in the traditional sense, like politicians, musicians, and movie stars? Or do you follow the lives of people on Instagram or YouTube? Call in 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation in a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're continuing our conversation with Julie Klamm about why people are so invested in the lives of celebrities. She's the author of the book, The Stars in Our Eyes, The Famous, The Infamous, and Why We Care Way Too Much About Them.
You can tell us what you think at 800-642-1234 or by posting on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us if you follow the lives of celebrities or if a celebrity played a big role in your life growing up. Tell us who you find compelling and why. Do you have a theory on why movie stars, musicians, even social media stars captivate people's attention so much? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Julie, it often happens. This is real life. These aren't just cartoon characters. They're people. And it often happens that some of these celebrities, actors, musicians that we admire have dark personal lives and personal failings sometimes. You think about Woody Allen, Bill Cosby. You have numerous lists in your book about people who had affairs with the nanny. So how do you handle that love for the art that someone makes, but you're really disappointed in who they turn out to be sometimes as people?
Well, you know, I sort of talked about in the book that I kind of look at it as how significant the artist is to me, and what the infraction is. You know, I mean, I didn't really, you know, if somebody has a sex tape leaked, it doesn't really change my opinion of their work. If somebody turns out to have a political opinion that I find abhorrent, I have a very hard time watching their work or, you know, patronizing anything that they do. With Woody Allen, it was really difficult. I grew up in a very preppy, waspy area. There were very few Jewish people. And Woody Allen was like the first cool Jewish person that I was aware of in high school. I'm sure there were many more, but I didn't know who they were. And everybody loved him, and he was really great. And all of a sudden, it was like, you know, the coolest thing to be a Jewish neurotic person, which I was. And then, you know, once the scandals started to hit, I mean, the whole thing with you know, Sun Yi, you know, it was not great. But I felt like something had changed for me. Later, when, you know, Marielle Hemingway wrote her book about him being, like, very lecherous to her when she was 17, you know, I realized I identify more as a woman than as a Jew, and, or, you know, equally, and it was sort of it for me, and it turned me off. At the same token, I have a lot of friends who are friends with celebrities or celebrities, and you don't necessarily get this, you know, the story that you hear is not always accurate. There's a tremendous amount of reinterpretation and spin. But, you know, I felt very disappointed. There was also a very good op-ed piece in the New York Times about from an African-American woman who grew up feeling like the Cosby family was one of the first depictions of a regular, you know, to her, a family that seemed like hers, and how crushed she was to find out about his, you know, whatever, his discrepancies. You know, it's very dependent, and it's a much bigger sacrifice if it's somebody who means a lot to you. I have heard some horrible things about people who I don't care about anyway. It wouldn't make any difference if I, you know, stop buying, you know, if I decided to boycott Justin Bieber. I've never bought a Justin Bieber album or anything. So whatever he does or says isn't really, you know, if I can say I hate him, and it's not going to change his profile.
I want to take a caller now. Let's go to Greg joining us in Stoughton. Greg, hi.
How you doing? I would like to say that I think what's going on in part is that people just want more drama. They lack meaningful purpose in their lives more and more, and there's a superficiality that life is like these days, which you can readily see in politics. And I think, you know, we're designed to be interested in drama, and if it's not there naturally in our lives, we're just going to look for it, you know, someplace else.
Greg, thank you for that. And Greg saying, you know, people don't have enough meaning in their lives, and it's a sign of shallowness maybe in our culture. I mean, is there any critique? You know, we hear the analogy to the fall of the Roman Empire, where people were obsessed with pleasure, and in this case, you know, celebrities. Do you think it's anything indicating that there's something wrong with our culture?
I think the way that I feel about it, and the people that I know who are interested in celebrity culture, it's like a funny, fun pastime. My friends who watch The Real Housewives, they do it and like text each other things about them. They're not investing any part of themselves in these situations. And you know, it's actually something that, you know, you can take lightly. I mean, there are certainly people who are obsessed and unhealthily obsessed with a celebrity. Once you're past the, you know, teenage age, you know, it might be something you want to talk to somebody about. But I think that, you know, I have a very filled life with a family and lots of dogs, and I still like to read about, you know, Mark Ruffalo.
All right, Greg, thanks for that. Let's go to Penny now in Ripon. Penny, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to share?
I was a big fan of John Lennon and Yoko Ono, and when before my daughter was born, I had a very difficult pregnancy, and it was very similar to the pregnancy that Yoko Ono had a short time earlier with her son, Sean. And so my husband sent her a letter just saying that we were going through the same thing. And then when the baby was born, he wrote again and said that we had a beautiful daughter and she was healthy. And a few weeks later, we got a postcard in the mail saying, "Welcome to the world, Melissa. Love, Yoko."
Oh, that's a great story. So
wow,
she actually.
That's amazing.
That's
something I talk about too. Exactly the same thing. When I had my daughter, I had a really difficult pregnancy, and when she was born, my then husband had just lost his job. We were living in a one-bedroom apartment. She was in a bassinet right next to my bed. And I had this idea that Brooke Shields, who had a baby at the same time, was having the greatest new baby experience with her. You know, I thought she had a gorgeous nursery and a staff. She probably got to sleep. Somebody else was, you know, somebody was cooking. She could go to the gym. And then, you know, shortly after that, you know, I read about her very serious postpartum depression. You know, there was something about, I took comfort in this idea that there was somebody who was having an easier time than me.
And that takes us back to that idea of escapism and also comfort. And we're going to leave it there. Julie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Julie Clam. She joined us to talk about her new book, which hit the shelves yesterday. It's called The Stars in Our Eyes, The Famous, The Infamous, and Why We Care Way Too Much About Them.